This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello, and welcome to episode 32 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I am your host, Keith Burgun. I'm excited about today's episode. I think it's going to be a pretty good one. I expect it to be a longer one than some of my past episodes, but I'm not sure. It's really hard for me to gauge how long. Sometimes I do an episode, I'm like, man, that was a really long one. And then it's really short, and I've had sort of the opposite happen too. Some of that happens, I'm sure, in the editing process. I do edit these a little bit, and sometimes I'll go off onto a tangent or something, and things kind of get away from me, or sometimes I'll have to go back in and edit in new parts that it's something I forgot to talk about. So they're mostly one take, but there's a good amount of like chopping after the fact that can change the length. Anyway, you don't need to know about that, but I know it's been a while since my last podcast episode, for me anyway. I've been trying to do, you know, for the first like 25 episodes or so, I did like one twice a month, one every 2 weeks, and I've gone down to like one per month recently. And there's a lot of reasons for that. A lot going on in my life. I'm doing a lot of games. I'm trying to get, you know, I'm trying to break my pattern of just making one game every like 4 years or so on average. Trying to get one out, I don't know, every 1 to 2 years for the next few years. So we'll see how that goes. So today I have two really big topics. I'll give you guys a general update on some things, some of my games that I'm working on really quickly up front. And then I have two big topics to talk about. One of them is a very mechanical sort of thing that's kind of my traditional wheelhouse of talking about strategy game design. And one is more of like a social thing. And I'll put the social thing later so that, you know, I know some people are not into that as much. And so you can just listen to the game design-y one if you want, and then you can stop listening when I get to the social one. I'll let you know when I get there. So first off, what's new with me in terms of the games I'm actually working on? Well, I'm technically sort of working on 4 games right now, but 2 are on the front burner and 2 are on the back burner. The 2 that are on the front burner currently are both video games. One of them is a video game for Dino Farm, the company that made Oro and 100 Rogues. And that one we're looking into getting some kind of venture capital maybe for that or some other form of funding. We're looking around for different options. Probably not going to do a Kickstarter for that. I have like pretty decent reason to believe that, video game Kickstarters are tricky unless you're like one of those, I don't know, like Hideo Kojima could do one. But if you're a small indie like us, it's difficult. And I have a strategy video game that I'm working on just by myself. And I'm really excited about that one because it's really moving along. And in fact, next week, I believe, like probably next weekend, we will start a actual beta of the game. And pretty much anybody who listens to this and is interested or knows about the game and wants to get involved with the beta, you're totally welcome. The beta will probably happen on the Dino Farm forums, just because we have kind of a community there of people who get my whole thing. And please come by. It's a single-player strategy game. If you liked Oro, if you liked 100 Rogues, or things like that, I definitely recommend you come on by. Actually, I wrote a recent article about how I'm re-theming that game, and I just hired a new artist for that, and I'm very excited to show the art of this person. I think that people will really like it. Anyway, so that's my little personal update. So the first big thing I'm going to talk about today is this idea of thinking in strategy games. I think that we put a lot of emphasis on decision-making, and, you know, how, there's that famous Sid Meier quote about, like, games are a series of interesting decisions. And, you know, I kind of think that existing games fall into sort of 2 categories. There's games that are very much, like, reactive, and, like, you have very little time to think about anything. And you pretty much just have to do what you can with what you have that's looking you right in the face right now. And those tend to be pretty random or execution-y. And execution-y, as you may know, is, to me, just another form of randomness. And then there's, like, strategy games. So things like chess or things like Euro games, which allow you to calculate a ton of information. The information horizon is like pushed way far out. You can see probably the whole entire game state to the end. That's the case in chess, in theory anyway. I know that humans can't actually do that, but, you know, it's unlimited, technically. So you should kind of, you know, go as far as you can with that. And that's something I've talked about before in that article, look-ahead contests and the information horizon articles are good places to review that kind of stuff. So I've already talked about, I wrote an article more recently about how you can minimize calculation in games worth playing. And I think I have another level on that whole discussion that I can talk about today, which is that there should be like kind of no calculation, or like almost no calculation, really. I need to explain that a little bit, because it's technically not no calculation, but the big message is that the picture of someone sitting there and like thinking about their decision is really, I think, a deformity on what strategy games are all about, because strategy games don't take place in the decision. I think that we put way too much emphasis on the decision. The decision's the input. That's where you make your input into the game, and so it is important from a design perspective. But I think that we overemphasize it when we picture, you know, people just sitting there and like churning and thinking and thinking. That's really not how it should work, because games are supposed to be a measure. They're a contest of understanding a system, a complicated system. I used to call them contests of decision making. This is a good distinction. They're not contests of decision making. Decision making is just the input. You may as well say they're contests of button pushing. You know, it's actually a contest of understanding. So this understanding process that happens in games, it doesn't just happen when you are making the decision. It's happening at all points. Probably actually the most fundamental part of the understanding process is the critical, you know, the win or loss state at the end of a match. That is the most, that, if anything, my big message is that's the main point of games. That's the you know, sort of the linchpin, or the main axis on which games revolve. Not decisions, but the win or loss. Because the win or loss is the fundamental piece of information that your brain will be using to assess, you know, the quality of given moves, and just to understand how this machine works. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to find better and better understanding of the system. The win and loss is the, it doesn't by itself tell you a ton about the system, but it's this completely necessary piece of information that without which you can get no real understanding of the system. I mean, you can get very limited understanding of the system. You can get like, oh, well, when I move this piece there, another piece can't move there, or like, you know, things like that. There are mechanical sorts of things that, of course, you can learn in it, but that's all learning in like a toy sense. There's no strategy. Strategy cannot exist without that win-loss state, because strategy is a plan for reaching that win-loss state. And so that's really a big difference between toys and games, is that toys don't have the strategy element. They are just an exploration of a system. Like, let me see what happens when I do this, when I pull on this, when I push this. Strategy is you have a distinct goal and you're trying to understand the system well enough that you can reach the goal. So in a way, this understanding paints games as a bit more contest-like than I previously thought, which I like. I actually think that unifies the whole system of forms a little bit more, because before I people have complained about the contest to game jump a lot, and I think that this is one reason why, is that, you know, like the whole thing about saying that they're contests of decision making, that's sort of strange. They are contests of understanding. And when you think of it that way, so think of it as like, so in a contest, a normal contest, a real contest, you have some resource, let's say a weightlifting contest. You can push, I don't know, 500 pounds of force in a direction, or pull that much in like a tug of war. So you have some number of like potential force that you could use to pull, just based on the shapes of your muscles and all kinds of biological things that actually put a hard limit on the amount of force that you can put on a rope or some object. And a contest is a simple linear measurement of that. How much can you do? And there may be some, like, you know, psychological things that are involved there too, but there shouldn't be strategy. Like, they do everything they can in a contest to cut out any semblance of strategy. So, you know, you shouldn't be able to, like, come up with some weird plan and do some strange thing, because we're actually trying to measure who is stronger. An even better example is something like a weightlifting contest. If you, they want two people to lift the barbell over their head in exactly the same way, because they don't want anyone using strategy. They literally do just want to see whose muscles are stronger, and who has more lifting power. So if you, like, moved into some weird pose or got some strange step ladder, or, you know, or there's all kinds of things you could do that would sort of count as, like, very, very rudimentary strategies for doing it better, they would say that's against the rules. So that's a big distinction with contests and games. However, here's the thing. Your ability to make decisions, your ability to make a decision based on something, is completely dependent on your understanding of the system. This kind of, like, touches on, you know, sort of free will discussions and things like that. But, you know, based on whatever you have some model of the system. And based on your model of the system, it kind of is a linear operation of coming up with the best, you know, move, the best answer to a question about that system that you can produce. And by the way, I'm factoring in here creativity and sort of conjecture. You know, David Deutsch, in his amazing book, The Beginning of Infinity, which, by the way, I recommend strongly to everybody. I've probably talked about it on the last five episodes. He talks about conjecture and how that's that's, like, sort of this fundamental part of science and creativity. I think that that's really what decisions in games are about. You're expressing some understanding of a system, and it is a very, I think actually even creativity is kind of like a linear measurement of your understanding. In order to be creative, you need to have a certain amount of understanding of a system. Like, we have those like eureka moments that feel like they come out of, like, nowhere. You can't have those without actually understanding the system to some extent. So those are just expressions of the model, the internal model. And that's kind of what I'm trying to get at here. It's all about that internal model of the system. The questions that games ask you, the times when you're asked to make decisions, are just asking you questions about your model and seeing how well your model matches up against the reality. There is an actual objective reality. If your questions are slightly bad, then you will lose. If your questions are slightly good, then you will win. Okay, so what, assuming someone accepts this, and please feel free to push back on this at all, what am I saying? I'm not saying that thinking happens at all times. That's the thing. Thinking is important, but it's not something that just happens at the moment of the decision. It's something that happens all the time. And the moment of the decision actually can be pretty effortless on part of the player, because they're just looking at the board and they're comparing it to their model and they're saying, okay, I see that I want to make this move, you know, and sometimes that'll be a little bit more of a, you know, you'll have a little, it won't be a little less automatic, a little more thinking is required. But, you know, for the most part, that's not the case. Now, so let me actually, before I go into my therefore statements, which will, you know, they'll be like guidelines for game design. Let's talk about, do systems that work this way exist now? Like I was saying earlier, I think there's, like, kind of two kinds of systems that exist right now. There's, like, the super execution-y, fast, just, you know, something in your face, immediately react kind of things. I would say, like, Street Fighter fighting games are definitely that way. And then you have, like, your super thinky strategy games. You don't have a lot in the middle, and you don't have a lot that Because what you want is a pretty small information horizon, a pretty small amount of known open information, so that the player can't just, you know, calculate everything. You want them to have to analyze and make more heuristic choices based on their model. You don't want them to just sit there and just be like, okay, I'm going to move here, he'll move there, I'll move there, he'll move there. Boom, it's going to work, which is the case in chess a lot of the time, at least at the, you know, close level. So there aren't a lot of games that meet this criteria right now. The ones that come closest, and I've talked about Serlin's Codex. I think that actually comes closest of any games that I've played. And I would say that actually, even though they have other problems, the whole family of like magic games are on this axis pretty good. They have other like massive, massive problems. Being a CCG is just awful. They're just super like random and unfair random. And, you know, every match you don't actually have a 50% chance to win, no matter who you're playing against. You have no idea what your chance to win is. It's totally based on, not totally based on, but like heavily weighted based on, you know, what cards you draw and all these random effects. There is output randomness in these games. So by no means am I like endorsing those games. But I do think that the basic core of them, where, you know, you have a very, I mean, there's not a lot of calculation you can do in Magic, or those kinds of games in general. And if there was more of a structure there, which is why I think Codex is the best of them by far, it has a structure with the patrol zones and the buildings and a few other mechanisms, the deck building. So if you have a little more structure, then you actually have, you have a pretty good system going there. But there's not a lot of games that meet that criteria. Now, with that said, all of my future games, or almost all of my future games, certainly the vast majority of my future games will try to meet this criteria. So what are, okay, so now what are some ways that, what are some ramifications of this, like guidelines that we can use for better design based on this understanding that the decision, it's not all about the decision. Well, how much time in a turn-based game or a real-time game should you give players in order to make their decision? We're going to talk about that, but first we're going to talk about, you know, we've already talked about, just quickly to review, how much should the player be able to calculate? Minimize it as little as possible. Probably not zero. There's probably always going to be some calculation that the player is able to do, but minimize it as much as possible. Okay, so that's thing number one, and that's something I just wrote an article about, and you should go back and check that article out. I'll post it in the show notes. The other thing that's newer is timers. How long should you have to take your turn or to do your to make an input once there's new information in your face, in the case of a real-time game? Because, you know, if we don't want, like, first of all, there's nothing to calculate in our system, or very little to calculate. We also don't want players to necessarily sit there like churning on like heuristics and like, you know, kind of like musing for very long. We kind of want just to get a good read of their model. We don't want them to like, I don't know, second guess themselves like 10, 15 times and, I don't know, discuss it and post a picture on the internet and say, what should I do, people? And, you know, we don't want that. We want an accurate representation of what your model is. So the answer, in my opinion, and this is the big takeaway, I think, of this episode, this is the big like guideline, is that you should give players just enough time to make their input comfortably so that they don't make an input that they don't mean to make. They don't, like, they're not rushed. They shouldn't be rushed. But at the same time, they, we don't want there to be no timer for very practical reasons. We do need there to be a timer, A, to make sure that games are getting over with quickly, and so that, you know, I mean, there's fairness issues, like, you know, a player just takes forever to do his turn, literally forever. So like, you have me basically cornered and I just say, oh, I'm still thinking about my turn, and then like 10 years later I'm like, I'm still thinking about my turn, sorry. That's kind of a fringe thing, but it's something. And but more importantly, you want games on a very practical level to be able to be completed in a timely fashion, because like I said, the final feedback the win-loss is super important. We want players getting there. We want players getting there as frequently as possible. And, you know, players will have a finite number of hours to play your game and in their lifetime. And so let's get them there as often as we can while... So we want it to be as... Basically, we want the timer to be as short as possible while still not rushing the player and making sure that they're making the move that they intend to make. So for most games, especially games that don't have a lot of calculation, I tend to think that, I mean, between 8 and like 20 seconds a turn for most games is plenty. I kind of think like 8 seconds is a decent amount of time. Because, again, we don't want them sitting there churning and thinking and going crazy. It's okay if they do that once in a while, but not for more than, you know, a minute. So I like the idea of a bank. That's fine. They do that in a lot of games, like some chess variants. And I know recently Prismata did that. That's the criteria, though. So that's the first section of this show. Please let me know what you think of that. And we're going to move on to the next topic. Okay, so like I said, this one's a bit more of like a social issue kind of thing. It's I recently read this article on IGN. I think it came out, just on December 1st. And it's called "Are Guns in Video Games Holding the Medium Back?" And obviously, this is something I've talked about a lot. Violence glorification. I think gun worshiping is a major component of our media culture landscape, especially in video games, but also in action movies and television. And I think that's a problem. So, one thing that always bothers me about these articles, now granted, this is IGN, so it's not like, you know, I mean, they're a very like corporate kind of, you know, you sort of don't really picture real people working there. You sort of picture everything that comes out of them, like being some product of a boardroom meeting held by like lawyers or something. But no, I think there are people that work there and write for them and stuff. I don't think we should expect like cutting edge thought. With that said, there's something to be said for non-cutting edge thought in that it may represent a larger amount of people in terms of, you know, how it thinks about issues. So yeah, right off the bat, there's like a subtitle to this article. It's talking about guns in games. And of course, as is so often the case, the author has to first demonstrate his gun-worshipping street cred before saying anything critical. And the quote underneath the title is, "Guns dominate the blockbuster video game space. Is this still a good thing?" I love that the word "still" in there. Like, of course it was a good thing. I mean, geez. But is it still, you know? Like, there's no possibility that it maybe was never a good thing. So it talks about this game. I think it's called American Dream or something. I don't have the note. I didn't write that down. But it's this game. Sort of looks like an indie art kind of game, and it actually sounds like a great premise. It's like sort of 1950s themed, and you do everything with your two hands. Either are guns or have guns in them, and you just have to do everything with guns. So you like, you know, open the fridge with a gun, and you just do every routine, everyday tasks with guns. It's great. It actually reminds me a little bit of last season's South Park episode where everyone in Stan's family just like kept whipping out guns. Everyone got guns. Just like at the dinner table, people would just pull out guns and point them at each other when there was arguments, which I thought was very, very good. So I'm going to just read a bunch of quotes from this article and then sort of react to them. So here's one quote. "Of course, there are a couple of very simple reasons guns in video games are so popular. They're a great test of skill, a core tenant in video games, and they feel damn good to wield." So I'm going to stop right there because there are already a couple things I find objectionable. Guns are a great test of skill? Yeah, incidentally, that's true, I guess. But that's, I mean, there's jumping is too. I mean, any action thing is a great test of skill. Even other violent things that don't involve guns, like, fighting or... You know, dancing is certainly a great test of skill. Those dance games, DDR and such. And they feel damn good to wield. The word damn there to me is like kind of damning. Because why would you put the word damn there? They feel damn good to wield. It feels very much like the author is posturing there. That they're trying to establish their like gun street cred. And they're almost like kind of like they're glorifying it just even in the text of talking about it. Feels damn good. Like trying to be cool. In this like action hero kind of way, like Duke Nukem. It's very strange. So yeah, that's weird. Especially because there's this other sentence that I considered mentioning, which is, for many of us who grew up in Antipodean countries, I'm not even sure that's the way that word is pronounced, in Antipodean countries, our obsession with guns in video games was and continues to be in contrast to our nonplussed environment. Using nonplussed like that and Antipodean. And then later he says, feel damn good to wield. It's like, first of all, that sentence with the Antipodean and all that stuff in there, that I just think that's just like very, that's also like posturing of different kind in writing. Find a synonym that people know. Okay. Like that's, I think, a good writing, tip for people. If you're writing a word and you are pretty sure like 90% of people won't know this word, then use a different word that people do know. Cause the point of writing is not to show how many weird words you know, but to communicate. And forgive me if I've mispronounced that Antipodean word. I literally had to look it up. And yeah, maybe that makes me a stupid guy, I guess. So anyway, going back to this feeling damn good to wield, that's totally a measure of the... By the way, if guns in games feel good, that's because good artists, good sound designers, good production values went into it, and that's why it feels good. I mean, there is another thing to it, which is, you know, maybe if you have, to some extent, a little bit of, like, gun worshiper in you, which you probably do because you've grown up in our society. I do. You know, that might feel good in that sort of, like, godlike power sort of sick kind of way. I think that is, it does tap into that, and that's a problem. But beyond that, guns feel good because they've got good production values. I've played some games where guns did not have good production values and they did not feel good to wield. People probably would be angry with me for this, but I had real trouble back in the day playing the original Deus Ex because the guns, I was used to the guns in like Doom and other, you know, I guess Duke Nukem and Quake, although I had some problems with the guns in Quake, Half-Life. And then I played the original Deus Ex, and I found the guns to be extremely unsatisfying to use entirely because of their production values. I remember, like, the shotgun sounded like, I don't know, like a broom pushing around on the floor or something. It just didn't sound powerful. Animations were, like, weak. The feedback was just weak. And so, you know, any action that is coupled, is produced well, I mean, look at, like, how it looks when, you know, if Pixar made a video game about, I don't know, like planting a garden or something, they would add absolutely amazing feedback to everything that you do. Watering a plant would feel damn good. This whole thing is just him trying to establish his gun worshiping cred. I forget the author's name at the moment, but they also wrote a comment in the comment thread, which I will get to. Popping a video game head gives us immediate visceral feedback that can be chained together in a constant dopamine manipulation in the brain. A zen-like flow. Quote, video game player tastes as of right now, much like moviegoer tastes, lean toward the exciting and visceral over the slow and methodical, says Kifaldi, who is somebody that was interviewed, I guess, for this. Yeah, so there's this idea of the visceral over the methodical, and I mean, that's true. I agree with that. I mean, basically, I think all that is there is a bias towards the easy, the accessible over the deep, over the slow and methodical and you know, a little bit more difficult to get into. Of course, there is going to be a bias towards the accessible, but this is, this has nothing to do with guns. Nothing there. Now, popping a video game head, which, by the way, is like, that's how we're talking in this article. Popping a head. It's like, really think about that. I mean, and again, you know, if Pixar made a game about, I don't know, like drinking soda or quilting, I have no doubt that they would give you immediate visceral feedback that can be chained together in a constant dopamine manipulation in the brain, a zen-like flow. Absolutely. Not that Pixar is a game developer. I'm just using them because I'm thinking of like Inside Out and the way that characters move and the way that there's like effects and sounds, and it's just like the best production values ever. Okay, so here, let's dig into another quote. From a development perspective, adding guns to your game has a dual benefit. Wolfenstein and Doom helped define the role of guns in video games, and those games came out of a country that defined itself through guns. Kind of weird. Quote, guns are satisfying to use, and they exist in the real world, says McDonald. You have easy, replaceable models for design, and there are lots of variants in them and the designs. And there are a lot of variants in them and the designs. If you want to make a good shooter, you already have 10 designs right there. But if you want to make an action game, you have to figure out the classes, or you have to figure out different weapons. It's more complicated. So, the dual benefit... I don't hear a dual benefit there. I just, it's like so much just like assumption. Like there's so much just like, just automatic. Guns are good. But yeah, so there's two things. Guns are good. And also, guns are blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like, there's just all this like presupposition in this article. And I wonder if other people notice that. Wolfenstein and Doom helped create the role of guns in video games, define the role of guns in video games, I agree. And those games came out of a country that defined itself through guns. Weird. What does that mean? How did America define itself through guns? Are they saying, I don't even know how that could possibly make any sense. I mean, I guess they're saying like we fought a war of independence with guns, or... I don't know what that means. I do know that guns are obviously a huge part of American culture. That's just what they mean. Guns are satisfying to use, and they exist in the real world. I mean, again, the satisfying to use is just, you know, sort of that's just asserted. I mean, you know, they're satisfying to use when they're made well, or maybe they're talking about real world guns, in which case, I don't know, satisfying is kind of pretty subjective there, and has a lot to do with how the way you think about guns. I can tell you, for me, it wouldn't be satisfying to shoot a gun. That would not be the word I would apply to that. And this kind of goes into the whole, like, people not understanding that, like, politics affects everything, that everything is political. Because like, a lot of people will be like, no, it doesn't matter what you think about, like, Second Amendment or, like, guns or anything like that. No matter what you think, if you shoot a gun, you're just like, damn, that's awesome. Like, that's kind of the mentality that a lot of people have about guns, that guns are this, like, just, like, magical, totally transcendent, valuable experience. Like, everyone should shoot a gun. It's like having sex or something. Like, it's this thing that just everyone needs to do. So, and then they go on to basically say that you can just use guns from real life. But that's... I mean, so you can use any real life objects. You can use cars. There's cars in real life. You can use boats. There's boats in real life. You can use flowers. You could use literally anything that there is in real life for a game. Now, granted, there is a shooter game design that's out there that you can just copy. Yes, you can do that. You could also just copy DDR. You could also just copy 100 other kinds of games that exist. You could just copy The Sims. And what they're saying here is, I think when they say, but if you want to make an action game, you have to figure out the classes. I think what they're saying is, if you don't copy guns and just make a shooter, you're going to have to actually design a game. You know, so watch out for that. So, I mean, yes, sorry, you will have to design a game. Let's do a couple more quotes. Quote, realism is a trend in the current mainstream space, felt most keenly in gritty shooters and action games. So it's no surprise that dissonance can be felt when guns are wielded by protagonists who are painted as realistically vulnerable or empathetic. The recent Watch Dogs 2, for example, gives players the option to mow down people with by the dozen with 3D printed assault weapons. yet its protagonist is presented as easygoing and kind-hearted. So they're talking about this, and they use the term ludonarrative dissonance, which for some reason in games culture, like, people just hate that term. I have issues with it. I don't like the term ludo at all. And I think that using narrative is also like, let's just pick the biggest, weirdest words that we can. I mean, narrative is not a weird word, but in combination with ludo narrative, like, why don't you just say like story game dissonance, you know? So anyway, or story interactivity dissonance. Use words that people know and understand. Don't just like, I don't know. But anyway, people hate that term, ludonarrative dissonance, and they hate it because, I mean, it's true. They don't like the fact that that's what happens. I mean, you either can have a character that has their own motivations and is a real character that's going to have, that's, you know, supposed to be empathetic or supposed to be not empathetic or supposed to be whatever, and then you give the player control over how that character behaves, and they're going to do things, or they at least have the ability to do things, that betray whatever that character is. It's very simple. So anyway, I agree with this part of this article that's talking about the dissonance. That's not really directly related to guns. That's actually any time you do anything that breaks with the character. Guns are not the fault of this. So, you know, it's, I guess that, like, people are starting, like, just sort of barely starting to figure out, like, that guns are kind of problematic in games. And so this is one area where the issue of ludonarrative dissonance is becoming clear to people, because they're starting to, like, be like, huh, do I really, like, is it good that I'm, like, just, like, shooting people, like, mowing down tons of people in, like, an airport or something? Another claim in this article is, the status quo is limiting the stories we can tell in our games. So the basic idea is, like, all your games, all your stories have to involve, like, guns and shooting, and that's limiting for the stories that you can tell. And I agree. I agree with that. And I also agree that it limits the actual mechanical, you know, interactive design possibilities. But I also wonder if, like, is it those aesthetic things that, like, guns, is that the reason that these things are so limited? Or is it, like, market? Is it, like, maybe if we didn't have guns and this, like, obsession with guns in our country, there would be something else that is just expected to be in games and every game would have it, whatever it was. So I'm not sure that necessarily applies to what is being talked about here either. And it kind of reads as, like, okay, I can't say guns are bad because, you know, obviously guns are, like, the best thing in the whole world. So I guess I'll say, like, well, maybe we shouldn't always do guns just, like, for variety's sake. Like, that's basically the argument here. So here's something I agree with. Quote, just as we look back and laugh at the absurdity of a 19th century film audience jumping out of their seats at the sight of an approaching train, I think the people of the 22nd century will mock our astonishment of pointing a cursor at a 3D representation of a human and watching them go ragdoll. That's totally, absolutely. That I'm really glad to hear somebody else say that. That's kind of like what I was trying to get at with my You Have a Gun game, which is just like the interactive dumbness of the shooting mechanism, you know, coupled with just the gun worship thing. And also, I like that somebody is talking about how games will progress dramatically and how we're in, like, kind of, you know, I like the silent film era kind of comparison. I think that's sort of apt. I know that the timelines don't exactly match up in terms of, like, how long video games have existed and how long film existed. There's reasons for that. I mean, film advanced quickly because it's sort of related to plays and it's sort of related to other kinds of storytelling, novels and other. We've been doing storytelling formally for a long time. So the idea that film would advance pretty quickly kind of makes some sense to me. Okay, so I also wanted to talk about the author that wrote this also wrote a comment, which I thought was interesting and sort of strange that they did this. And it was like a featured comment. They have that as a thing on IGN. So this is the author of this article. And they wrote, "Hey, everyone, I recognize this is a controversial question, so please read the body text before going wild in the comments. There's no pearl clutching here, just genuine curiosity." So it's like, don't worry, I'm not making any claims. But yeah, just genuine curiosity. It's good that they're asking a question, but it bothers me so much that, like, in order to make any kind of criticism, you have to first, like, and this is something I've talked about this with the extra credits, which, you know, those guys are smart people, and they make these videos about game design, and they make these observations, and a lot of their observations, like, sometimes I'll watch their videos, and I'm like, yeah, that's true, yes, I'm glad someone's talking about that, and at the end of the video, they're like, but it's all okay, and it's great, actually, all these problems are not problems, they're good things, yay, and it's like, wait, what, why, and I feel like there's just, God, it's like this, like, cult-like thing with video games, that you have to just, like, first completely pledge your allegiance first, and after you make any kind of criticism, you have to, like, sandwich it with two, like, statements of, like, just total worship. And don't worry, I'm not saying anything, you know? And that's a real problem that I think we need to get over. It's okay to say things, you know, it's okay to make real criticisms and to actually say, you know what, guns or whatever it is, it doesn't have to be guns. It could be anything, whatever you find objectionable. You find something objectionable and you're like, you know what? And I don't like this thing anymore. I reject this thing now. That's okay. You know, politics influences us. You may not like to admit that, but the reality is that everyone is influenced by their political views. That changes the way you perceive things. It's why if you are a hard left politics person and you watch someone like, Dennis Miller or something, you don't find him very funny. I mean, there may be other reasons for that too. Whereas on the other hand, if you're someone on the hard right and you don't find, Jon Stewart funny, that may also be because jokes are built on premises, and premises are political views about how the world is. And if those premises don't connect, the joke just, like, falls flat. So anyway, everything's political. Don't be afraid to say statements. You know, it's okay to be wrong in your criticism. People have done that before. It's all right. Yeah, I just think that this author shouldn't have written that comment at the end. I mean, I think there's a lot of problems with this article, but I really think that comment at the end. Yeah. The net of this article is a positive thing. I'm glad that it was written. I'm glad that people are asking that question. I think honestly, it's like one of those things. Like, bad ideas can't really stand the light of day. Like, you shine light on them and, like, it starts becoming more and more clear how they're bad. And so just, even if this is just like, even if this is somebody who does, like, totally worship guns and loves them in video games and never wants to play a game that doesn't have a gun in it. And they wrote this, like, just as some, like, total thought experiment, it's still positive in that it's going to get more people to, like, think about that. And so that's a good thing. And so while I've been critical of many of the things in this article, overall, I think it's a net benefit. And I'm glad to see it on IGN. And I'd like to hear more of this kind of stuff out there. Hopefully with a little bit less shame, or, like, you know, trying to weasel out of having said anything. It's okay to say things. But anyway, that is pretty much my episode. And thank you for listening. And hopefully, another reason I was sort of late on this episode was I got pretty sick. Right around, I think it was like November 9 at like 3 a.m., I got this like horrible cold. And I'm not joking either. I actually did get a really horrible cold at that moment. And I still actually, my voice is like a little bit crackly. And so I'm just recovering it from it now. But, you know, hopefully I can get back to one episode every 2 or 3 weeks from now on. Please let me know what you think of this episode in the comments, and let me know if you disagree, you have any criticism. You don't have to say, I love your podcast so much, it's the best, but here's all these extremely horrible problems with your podcast, but they're all good, and I love your podcast, it's great. You don't have to do that. Not that anyone would for this podcast, but just making a joke. Okay, so anyway, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.